Thank you very much indeed. It's difficult to explain to you how happy and privileged I am to be here. Because back in 1945, which is a long time ago, I went up to university in Cambridge, England. It was just after the war. It was a very privileged time. And I met there a young South African. His name was Patrick Niven. He looks a bit older there than when I met him. When I met him, I was able to explain to him, much to his mystification, as to why it was that the University of Cambridge in England still had buildings that were 700 years old and somewhat lacking in modern facilities, which he didn't appreciate very much. But he was able to explain to me a great deal about Africa and African natural history, of which, of course, I knew nothing. He persuaded me to read a book written by his grandfather, Jock of the Bushveld. And from that, I learned quite a lot. He taught me how to say things like, when I got overexcited, yerryong. And we remained friends for many years. And he kept asking me to come to Africa. He was going to show me things. And one way or another, I kept trying to do so. And one way or another, I kept failing. Then he told me that his mother, daughter of Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, had founded the Fitzpatrick Institute of African Ornithology and invited me to come and speak to it. Somehow or other, it never happened. I promised I would come, and somehow I never did. Now, sadly, it's too late. Patrick died a few years ago, but I am keeping my promise to him as best I can. I want to tell you now about a very remarkable Englishman. His name was Alfred Russel Wallace. 200 years ago, well, 150 years ago, 152 to be precise, a very remarkable book was published called The Origin of Species. It was by Charles Darwin, and most biologists will tell you today that it is the most important book in the whole history of zoology. It is the book that makes sense of the natural world. But when the paper in which Darwin first explained his theory of the origin of species was published, there were, in fact, two names attached to it, his own and that of Alfred Russel Wallace. The two men could hardly have been more different. Charles Darwin was the son of a wealthy Shrewsbury doctor and became a wealthy man in the south of England. He did a trip around the world for 4 years, in which time he visited the Galapagos, but after that, he stayed in the south of England. He'd been to a public school and he'd been to university. Compare that with the other signature on that paper, that historic paper, Wallace's. Wallace was almost self-educated. He didn't go to university. He didn't go to advanced education. He had to earn his living to start with as a surveyor. Instead of spending merely 4 years around the world, he eventually decided to go to South America and later to Indonesia, and he spent most of his life overseas. A very different man from Darwin. But both men were obsessed by the natural world. Both men were collectors. Both men built up huge collections, for example, of beetles. Both men, as young men, wondered why there were so many different species of beetle. But Darwin, having done his beagle trip, came home. But how would Wallace go to see the tropics of which he dreamed? Eventually, he thought of a way. He and a friend would go to the tropics somewhere and collect specimens of beetles and birds and reptiles, snakes, lizards, mammals, and sell them to museums and wealthy collectors. They were working men. But Wallace's first trip was to South America. He spent 4 years there. He built up a huge collection. And then on the way home, in order to sell the collection and pay for his trip, 3 days out from sea, from leaving South America, the ship caught fire and sank. And with it went tens of thousands of specimens and all his notes. He was lucky to escape with his life. And you would think maybe that was enough, but no. When he got back home, he decided to go on another expedition. Because Wallace, as well as being interested in beetles, had one overwhelming passion, and that was for birds of paradise. Birds of paradise had been obsessing Europeans for 500 years. The first specimens came back after Magellan's expedition when he went round the world for the first time in 1522. And when they were in the eastern part of Indonesia, in the Moluccas, the local people gave him and his crew a very, very special gift. And they were several skins of a most extraordinary bird. From the sides of the bird sprang enormous, gauzy, golden plumes. They in themselves were an astonishment. But even more extraordinary, these birds had no wings and no feet. And Magellan the sailor said, "How come? How can there be a bird like that?" The fact of the matter was that the local people in Indonesia, in Ternate, had no idea. They had come traded from some mystic place far to the east, which was in fact New Guinea. But they had to have a story. So they told Magellan's men, these are very special birds. They float eternally in paradise. They have no need for wings, so no need for feet. And they feed on dew. And when they came back to Europe, the sailors told people that. And this drawing was published in 1599 and was still reckoned to be the truth. These were birds of paradise. And they weren't the only people to be impressed, those living in the Far East. People in this country, in Europe, were also fascinated by it. This is young Prince Charles, who was going to become King Charles I of England. And look at his side, by the left there, there is what? His hat, and in it a pair of golden plumes of the birds of paradise. Well, of course, the true nature of the birds eventually became known. And at the beginning of the 19th century, there was this illustration, which showed how local people would see the bird itself in real life. It'll come. And there it is. Painted remarkably by a man, a Frenchman called Lesson. But when Wallace decided to go out and get birds of paradise, still no one had ever seen birds of paradise displaying their plumes in their courtship dances. So Wallace set out, And in September 1856, he arrived in the Southeast Indies, as it was then called. And here he is. These are the tracks of his journeys. This is Java and Bali and Flores. And here is the end of New Guinea. And here is Sulawesi, where he made one of his bases as he explored all these islands, as this map shows. And in 1856, he left again from this journey, from his base here, down to the Aru Islands, which are in the south here of New Guinea. Next. There's his base, and this shows the density, the vast numbers of voyages that he made. Bear in mind, these weren't voyages with motors. These were voyages in locally built canoes and living under extraordinarily difficult positions. But eventually, he got to Dobbo, which is down here in the Aru Islands. And this was the center of birds of paradise plumes that were traded, had been killed or hunted in the Aru Islands and in New Guinea. And from here in Dobbo, they were traded all over the world to Nepal, where they are still, even today, part of the royal regalia of the kings of Nepal. There is Wallace. And around him you can see the traders who came here from all over the Orient to get these magical plumes. But then he went from Aru to the island of New Guinea itself. It's an immense island. It's 1,000 miles long. And there, to his enormous delight and excitement, he saw the birds of paradise displaying for the very first time. I should explain that there are over 40 different species of birds of paradise. But the famous ones, the ones that first came to Europe, the ones with those golden plumes, were the greater birds of paradise. And Wallace saw them in display and described it for the first time. But even when I started making natural history programs, no one had ever filmed wild birds of paradise in display. And then happily, after 2 or 3 visits to New Guinea and several attempts, we succeeded.
This at last is Wallace's picture come to life. He was the first European to glimpse this extraordinary spectacle, and he knew well, in general terms, what was happening. This is a female, and she's come to pick a mate from among the gorgeous males who are displaying. A young male. He's dancing even though he hasn't yet got his plumes. They don't develop until he's 6 or 7 years old. There are several young males here, putting in a little dancing practice. This, however, is almost certainly a female, because the males are starting the second stage of their performance, the bow, head down. The female has hopped onto the perch of the male of her choice. That's a straight invitation to mate. Act 3, the approach, head up. Act 4, the first physical contact. It looks rough, but presumably she likes this sort of treatment. She could easily move away if she didn't. And that's it.
Bear in mind his excitement. He was the first European ever to see that astounding display. And it excited him so much that with several specimens of the dead bird he collected, he returned to his base in Ternate and there started writing up a description. And with him he also had, because as I mentioned, there are a lot of different kinds of birds of paradise, he had also collected the smallest bird of paradise. They're sitting in front of him, down there. And we can see, when you look at them closer, that those birds are about the size of a thrush, and they have their tails, a curious little naked filament sprouting from their tail, which, in fact, ends in a thing that looks like a coin, which has given the birds the name of dollar bird, if we can see the next one. And the dollar birds had also been known for almost as long as the other more famous birds of paradise. And even in the 16th and 17th century, there were natural history books which also had the pictures of this strange little kingbird of paradise, as it was called. The kingbird is very, very different. It not only has these strange things from its tail, but its coat, its plumage, is a wonderful, glittering, almost metallic red. And as Darwin described it, its plumage has an intense cinnabar red with a gloss as of spun glass, is what he said. And indeed it is. We managed to film that one too.
The smallest member of the family, the king bird of paradise. He has yet another kind of tail. Two wire-like quills, each tipped with a little green disc like a coin. Not so obviously impressive as the ribbon tail, but wait till you see what he does with them. Wing spreads and this extraordinary, scarcely bird-like call are just the beginning of things. Just attention-grabbing ways to let any female around know that he's on his perch and about to display his prowess as an acrobat and a juggler. What could be more attention-grabbing than that? But that's not all. When he's really excited, he's got a final stunt, the pendulum. Here it is.
With that vision in his mind, Wallace returned to his base in the island of Ternate, and he was living in this particular hut, a tiny little hut. And it was there that he wrote, as he was lying in his hammock in a malarial fever, that one night the theory of natural selection leading to evolution of species, occurred to him. It's a very simple one as you describe it, but it has huge implications. I dare say everybody here knows what the simple form is, which is that animals tend to give birth to many more progeny than will survive, and those that do survive have the best and most effective characteristics which gave them that survival value. And they, in turn, pass that on to the next generation. And so, over many generations, new species arrive. It sounds simple, but in the implications are very complex and profoundly important. The idea occurred to him on one night, and then for 2 days, over 2 days, he wrote it out in some detail, and he sent it off by a canoe, initially, and eventually to a ship, to somebody in England who might give him an idea as to whether there was, as it were, anything in it. And he pondered on who he should send it to. And he decided that he would send it to Charles Darwin. Darwin was living in conditions that could scarcely be more different from that miserable, tiny little hut that Wallace was living in. He lived in this splendid house in Kent, and here all the learned gentlemen from London would go down to talk to him and discuss his ideas. Now, Darwin had been thinking about this problem himself, and 20 years earlier, he too had thought of the theory of natural selection leading to the evolution of species. So when that letter, next please, when that letter landed through his letterbox in Kent, coming from all the way from the other side of the world, setting out in detail the theory on which he had been working for 20 years, it was a bombshell. Why hadn't he published this theory? Well, only he could say, of course, but there are a number of reasons, one of which is that it was going to profoundly upset many Christian people in Europe, including his wife. Indeed so. But not only that, he was probably, we all know him to be, a most meticulous scientist. And he was looking for those last bits of evidence that make the case absolutely foolproof. But what was he to do now? Suddenly, this man who had only been corresponding with as another naturalist had got exactly the theory that he had been working on for the best part of his life. What was he to do? Darwin himself wrote to one of his friends and said, "I would far rather burn my whole book than that Wallace or any other man should think that I had behaved in such a paltry spirit as to steal it." So eventually, with the two of his friends, a professor of geology from in London and a botanist from Kew, they got together and they decided that Darwin would write a very shorter version of this big book that he'd been preparing, and that the two would publish it, would get it read at the meeting of one of the premier natural history societies, scientific societies in London, that is to say, the Linnaean Society. So Darwin was persuaded that this was the honourable thing to do. Meanwhile, while all this was going on, out in the East Indies, what was happening? Why, dear old Wallace was doing the sort of thing that any sensible man would do under any circumstances out there, which is to go looking for birds of paradise again. And there they were. So, of course, that declaration of the publication, the announcement of the theory, was done without Wallace's agreement. How could he give it? He didn't know. But when eventually he had been out in the farthest hardships of the world for now many years, and he decided the time had come that he really had to return. But before he did that, he had one last trip he wanted to do. And that was a thrill for him, because he found a new bird of paradise that he was sure was going to be the most astonishing creature of the whole family. He called it the standard wing. And this is the illustration of it that he puts in his book. Oh, that's him. But the next picture will show this extraordinary bird of paradise, which he found not in New Guinea. In fact, it's the only bird of paradise that really lives far away from New Guinea. It lives in Halmahera, which is to the west of New Guinea. And Darwin and Wallace was convinced that it was the most exciting thing they had ever seen. And I was able, in fact, for a long time, nobody knew where that actually lived. The skins that he brought back were very rare in museums. But eventually, other ornithologists managed to run it down, and we knew where those birds were displaying. So we went in search of them too.
A female. This male is certainly putting on a great performance. Is she, in fact, assessing and comparing the displays? A copulation. As ever, a matter of seconds. Another, same place. There seems little, to my eye at least, to choose between all the several dozen males, and I don't see how a female could make a proper choice. Maybe it is the perch in these great assemblies of competing males that is the important thing, as it also may be among the greater bird of paradise. If that is so, then in these mass displays, the males are not so much showing off to the females as posturing aggressively to one another, using their plumes to demonstrate their strength and vigour, as stags do with their antlers. That would enable them to establish a ranking between them all, and the boy at the top of the rank gets the number one perch. One of the mysteries about birds of paradise, as far as I'm concerned, is why, when they have such wonderful colours, do they do so much of their displays in the semi-darkness before dawn? It's only now that the sun is up that I can really see the full beauty of these wonderful plumes. The displays are over. It's time to get smartened up again after all that rough and tumble. The white standards are looking a bit bedraggled too, and at last I can see exactly how they're attached to the front of the wing. Is there a more elegant cravat in both shape and colour worn by any bird? I doubt it.
Wallace had now been away for nearly 8 whole years. He'd endured enormous hardships. He'd made 40 to 60 to 70 separate journeys in leaky local boats. He'd been sick, very sick, but he'd collected 110,000 insects, 7,500 shells, 8,050 bird skins, 410 mammals and reptile specimens, and he'd observed 5 different species of birds of paradise. The time had come to return home. So he had to go from New Guinea here all the way down, back to Indonesia, all the way to Singapore. And as he made that journey, next please, as he made that journey, he made a lot of observations all the way through. He noticed that there was a most extraordinary difference, a line, this line. On this side, New Guinea, there's Halmahera, where the standard wing was, his base was around here. All this area here, he found what? Marsupials, kangaroos, possums, honey-eaters among the birds and megapodes, and among the plants, eucalyptus. But as he crossed from Celebes, or Sulawesi as it's now called, or this line here, east of Bali, that little island of Bali, things changed quite extraordinarily. On this side, there were no marsupials, no kangaroos, no possums. Instead, there were monkeys and tigers and elephants and deer and amongst the birds, trogons and barbets. And of course, an observer of Wallace's stature not only noted it in detail, but pondered about it and noted that actually this island here, Sulawesi or Celebes as it was then known, is a kind of intermediate area. And he published this in his book, and it became known and is still known very properly as Wallace's line. And it is one of the observations that prefigured the theory of continental drift, which really became not accepted science until the middle of the last century. So when he got back from this trip, it was some time since his communication with Darwin. And he found that the world, the Western world, was still thrilled and excited and outraged to some by a book that had just been published. It was The Origin of Species. Its full title, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, had caused a huge sensation. The church was outraged because it left no room for the biblical account of creation. But he met at last Darwin, this man who had also got his name attached to that remarkable book. And the behavior of those two great figures is remarkable. You can find lots of examples in the last 100 years or so of great scientists who have been bitter rivals and have attacked one another. And you might think that Wallace had every reason for being jealous and feeling that Darwin had stolen his thunder. Darwin, after all, had published that book, and the theory was called Darwinism. But not at all. They met, and Darwin said, "You would, if you had my leisure, have done this work just as well and perhaps better than I have done." And Wallace, in reply, well, he wrote to one of his friends and said, "I do honestly believe that with however much patience I had worked and experimented on the subject, I could never have approached the completeness of Darwin's book. His vast accumulation of evidence, its overwhelming arguments, and its admirable tone and spirit, I really feel thankful that it's not been left to me to give the theory to the world." Nonetheless, Darwin, of course, did write a book. He called it by the name of Adventures in Malay Archipelago, as Indonesia is now known, was then known. And it contains descriptions of 18 different birds of paradise and illustrations of many of them. In fact, Darwin and he differed on the meaning of the birds of paradise. And Darwin was right and Wallace was wrong. Wallace thought that the males, with their wonderful displays, were, the main species, and that the female differed from them because they had to be remained not so obvious as they sat on their necks incubating their eggs. Whereas Darwin recognized that it was, in fact, the females who was choosing the males that was the driving force of evolution. He called it sexual selection. And the reason it happened, as we now know, in New Guinea, is that New Guinea is so rich, it is in a very real sense a paradise for birds. There's a lot of fruit, a lot of insects, a lot of food of all kinds, and very few predators. And so it's possible for the females to build the nests by themselves and to incubate the eggs by themselves without any attention from the male. The male is only useful in order to fertilize the eggs before they're laid. And that theory of sexual selection is now fully accepted. Well, one of the birds that Wallace described is this one. It's called the Parotia bird, the six-wired bird of paradise. And that is rather different from the other birds of paradise, because instead of displaying high in the trees, it displays on the ground. The fact that there are very few predators makes that possible. And so these birds of paradise develop themselves, they clean whole areas in the forest as a stage on which the male will perform. And what is more, not only does the male dance there, but the immature males, before they've acquired the full plumage of the male, will come and watch and, as it were, learn the dance as the male performs it before they too become mature and set up their performances on their stages. And we were lucky enough to film that too.
He's dressed entirely in black, except for that white disc on his forehead, though there is an iridescent patch on his chest that he can reveal when he wants to. And he does have those six black pennants on his head. But he dazzles his mates not so much with his costume as with his choreography. And that being so, he is particularly keen on clearing his stage of anything that might trip up a dancer. Now he's miming, going through the motions of clearing away leaves, even though there aren't any. The stage is now absolutely immaculate. And here's another of those juveniles who come to the arenas of their elders and betters to practice. Amazing, but how sad that none of the girls are here to watch. The master is back. And the audience is assembling. He is going to show how it should be done. First, the warm-up, ritualized runs across the stage. A little more mimed leaf clearing, mounting excitement in the dress circle. And now the performance begins. Thank you.
Wallace may not be as famous a name as Darwin's, but in his old age, he was fully honored with all the academic honors from around Europe and elsewhere. He may also have differed from Darwin on some details of the theory of the origin of species, and Darwin has usually proved right. But his book is an amazing book. And it contains, not only is it an adventure story, not only is it a story of scientific exploration, but it's full of deep thoughts. And he takes you with you, with him on his trips. There's a marvelous account of how when he had been pursuing, looking for the male of one particular species of bird-winged butterfly, which he had never seen before, and when finally he saw it, he was so excited, he said he nearly fainted. But he also says other profound things. Among them, he wrote this. I thought of the long ages of the past, during which the successive generations of these things of beauty had run their course year by year, being born and living and dying amid these dark, gloomy woods, with no intelligent eye to gaze upon their loveliness. Such a wanton waste of beauty. It seems sad that, on the one hand, such exquisite creatures should live out their lives and exhibit their charms only in these wild, inhospitable regions. This consideration must surely tell us that all living things were not made by man. Many of them have no relation to him. Their happiness and enjoyments, their loves and hates, their struggles for existence, their vigorous life and early death would seem to be immediately related to their own well-being and perpetuation alone. Indeed, they do. Thank you.